This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Fly Away by Lucy Christopher, narrated by Harriet Carmichael.
The Beginning. Every year, Dad waits for them. He says it means the start of winter when they arrive, the start of Christmas, the start of everything brilliant. When he was a boy, he would sit with Nan and Grandad in a field near the lake behind their house and wait. It was usually cold and dark, and he says he even sat through a snowstorm once. Even then, Grandad knew when they'd arrive. Dad used to think Grandad was magical for knowing that. I can remember waiting beside that lake too, but the memory is more like a dream than something real. The last time we all waited there together was 6 years ago, the winter before Nan died. The last winter the wild swans ever went to Grandad's lake. All of us were huddled by the edge of the water, and the blankets wrapped around my shoulders smelt like dusty drawers. Nan pushed a cheese sandwich into my hand, and Grandad passed around mugs of hot chocolate. I was sleepy and still, but I kept my eyes open. And then they came, appearing like something from a fairy tale. It was as if they'd sprung from the clouds themselves. The dawn light glinted on them, made them seem so white, silver almost. Their wings made the air hum. I still remember Dad's face as he watched them, his wide eyes, the way he bit the edge of his lip, as though he was anxious the birds might not make it. When they began to circle down the lake, Dad leant forward a little, as if he was imagining doing the landing himself. I loved them, even then, just like Dad. But they scared me too. The way they arrived out of nowhere, and so many of them. It was as if we'd dreamt them, as if they'd come from another world. And this year, it starts like that again. With Dad excited and rapping on my door. With the swans arriving. And everything changing. Chapter 1. Early morning. It's too cold to get out of bed, but already Dad's at my door. His fingertips drumming like rain.
Isla, he whispers. Coming? They're here. Up at the reserve, I'm sure of it.
I force my eyes to focus on the shadows around my bed. Desk, chair heaped with school clothes, jeans and jumper in a pile on the carpet. I hold my breath as I swing my legs out from under the duvet. Sit up, rub my hands over my arms. Dad knocks again.
Yes, okay, I'm up, I hiss.
I pull on the jeans and jumper. Find the thickest socks in my drawer. Hold my breath until I'm warmer. The heating hasn't gone on yet. It's too early, still dark outside. Dad creaks open the door, just a crack, but it's enough to see the wide grin on his face.
What are you doing in here? Anyone would think you're still half asleep.
I am.
I step towards him, touching my hair to see that it's not too tangled.
Don't worry, you're beautiful,
he whispers, already turning to go.
The birds won't care.
I go back to grab a hairband, then follow Dad down the stairs, still rubbing sleep from my eyes. We both avoid the middle step that creaks. Neither of us wants to wake up Mum or Jack. This is our time, mine and Dad's. Jack comes sometimes when he's not playing football, but mostly, it's just me and Dad watching them. Since that winter 6 years ago, the whooper swans have been arriving at a new lake on the Wetlands Reserve. Sometimes, I hope they'll come back to Grandad's lake, but Dad says they never will. He says it's too built up and overgrown there now. We pass the bathroom, and I think about stopping to brush my teeth, but I can feel Dad's excitement. Almost as if he is fizzing beside me. He's always like this. As soon as he's up, he just wants to move. The only thing he'll ever stay still for is the birds. He grabs the flask of coffee that's on the kitchen counter. I take a slice of bread from the bread bag, then go back and grab the whole bag in case Dad's hungry too. As Dad locks the house, I stamp my feet and breathe warmth onto my hands. Our front garden has turned white overnight. Frost makes the grass shimmer and turns our concrete path slick as an ice cube. I cling onto Dad's arm to get to the car. No one in our street is up yet. The place feels heavy and sleepy. Even the pub on the corner is quiet. We're the only ones awake in the whole world. Us and the birds. I turn the car heating up full, half grin at Dad to show him waking up, and we're on our way. It's not normally this cold when they arrive, I say.
Coldest snap for 20 years. Some people said they wouldn't come at all, but they have. They've been up north for days now.
How do you know they'll arrive today? Dad shrugs.
It just feels right.
He watches the road. I shut my eyes and try to grasp another quick moment of sleep, but I can hear Dad's fingers tapping on the steering wheel. I open my eyes again. Dad's chewing on his lip as usual. However sure he seems, he's still nervous every year that they won't turn up. There are dark circles under his eyes today, making him look more tired than usual. Mum says Dad's not well at the moment. She was worried when he got sent home from work early last week. But I don't know. He just looks tired to me. He pulls onto the ring road. We pass a long Tesco delivery truck with its fog lights on. Then that's it. No other vehicles. The sky's getting lighter, though. Already it's shifted from black to purple to grey. The hedgerows are coming into focus. I take a piece of bread from the bag at my feet and chew on it. Pass a piece to Dad. He switches off his headlights. Neither of us turns on the radio. It would ruin something somehow. It never feels like winter until Dad and I have done this. Until we've driven down these roads on this cold, early morning. The car ride to the reserve always means the beginning. Chapter 2. Dad drives past the pylons and buildings of the steelworks, past the entrance to the new power station. He turns left into the reserve car park, through puddles of muddy water. We're the only ones. It's too cold and early for even the hardcore bird watchers. No one's even been round yet to unlock the portaloo. If Dad wasn't with me, it would be so creepy being here. I get out of the car and listen. There's not one single sound, not even the trundle of the steelworks or the distant hum of the motorway. The sky is as heavy and grey as a blanket. It feels like snow's coming. Dad fetches the binoculars from the boot and we get going. It doesn't take long to walk to the lakes. Down the small dirt lane beside the stream, up the short ramp where the wind hits you at full force, and then between the reed beds. Dad walks fast, barely waiting for me to keep up. I'm breathing hard, and the cold air makes my throat hurt. Dad stops to pick up a scrunched crisp packet at the side of the path, his breath hanging in the air as he bends. We listen. I can't hear the usual honks and hisses. It's silent, too silent for them. Perhaps they've decided to stay up north after all. Dad would be so disappointed. He glances up at the sky, checking, but nothing. You sure it's today? Dad nods absently.
Has to be.
It's Dad who's always right about when they'll arrive now. Always. It's weird, but if there's one thing he's never wrong about, it's this. Sometimes I think it's the only thing he actually inherited from Grandad. The only thing that makes me convinced they're related. We turn the last corner before the main lake, their favourite lake. walk the final few metres. But there's no birds at all, not even any mallards or coots. The lake is as still as a stone, rippleless. For that moment, it feels like all the birds in the world have disappeared.
I don't get it,
Dad mumbles. He shakes his head, frowns. He spins around to check the sky from all angles. I look up too. Maybe we're too early, I suggest. Dad starts walking away from the lake. I think about the wild whooper swans. How clever they are to cover the hundreds, maybe thousands of miles between Iceland and here. Perhaps this year they're too tired to fly the final bit. Maybe they've given up on this wintering ground, just like they gave up on Grandad's lake. Maybe we'll just have to watch the mute swans instead. I almost laugh when I think of Dad being excited to watch mutes. We both know they have none of the noise and the mystery that the whoopers have. None of their magic. Dad walks down the main path towards the river. He's looking for a better view. He holds the binoculars to his eyes, scanning. Then his body goes still as he sees something. He takes the binoculars away, squints at the sky, then looks again. What is it? I ask.
Oh, no.
He lets the binoculars drop and they bounce against his chest. He starts forward into a run. I'm so shocked by the expression on his face that I don't even move for a second or two. I just watch him run down the path away from me. It's not the direction where the swans normally arrive from, but he's seen something. What? I shout again. He's already too far away to answer. I run after him. I'm glancing at the sky as I go, desperately trying to work out what Dad's seen. I don't have time to stop and use my own binoculars. He's running towards the far end of the reserve, near the corner where the new power station is. My eyes flick over it, the concrete building with its long waste chutes. The towering electricity pylons, only put up a few months ago. Suddenly, I realise what Dad must have seen, what he might be imagining. My stomach clenches into a tight fist, and I pick up my pace and pelt after him. I've nearly caught up with Dad when I see the swans. There are about 20 of them, fewer than usual, but they're big and definitely whoopers. They are stretched across the sky, flying swiftly in that huge V-shape, their wings beating in time. They must be aiming for the main lake, whooping and trumpeting as they fly. I stop and watch them. It's something I've seen so many times, but it still gets me. The dawn light on their feathers, the soft whir of wings, the way they are so huge and gangly, and yet look so graceful, so impossibly elegant. In that moment, I always understand why Dad likes them so much. Then Dad starts waving and screaming at them and jolts me back to the freezing cold morning.
We have to stop them,
he yells. I peel off my coat and fling it about above my head. I jump up and down. It's no good. They're only focused on getting to the lake. They don't notice us.
They're going to hit it, Dad says.
And I feel sick then. Really, truly sick. Because I know he's right. In the pale light, the swans can't see the wires linking the new pylons. Can't see the electricity fizzing in front of them. There are no red marker balls on the wires like the council promised. Nothing to show the birds what's there. I start screaming at them. Go away! Get back! But they don't see us. Even if they did, we can't stop them.
Isla, don't. Dad whispers. Don't watch.
But I have to. My mouth goes dry. I let my arms drop. The swan at the front looks so determined, its head bobbing in time with the beat of its wings. It looks confident about where it's going, vaguely hopeful. The rest of the flock trust it. Dad makes a tight, strangled noise as the swans falter. They slow down, change direction a little, and I think for a second that they've seen the wires. I let out a kind of breathless laugh as their wings beat furiously to take them higher. Maybe they'll make it. But it's too late. I hear the sizzle of the front bird hitting the wire, even from here. It tumbles towards the ground, its head twisting in surprise. Its wings limp, feathers spinning down. I feel a pain inside me, an ache beneath my ribs. I gasp, and Dad puts his arms out and gathers me towards him. He's breathing fast too. His whole body feels tense against me, shaking. I bury my head into his bonfire-smelling coat, but still I hear the smack and sizzle as another bird hits, and then another. I hold my breath. The ache inside gets worse. Then there's screeching, loud and hoarse, as the birds warn each other away. There are other birds joining in, a constant throb of panic and wings.
I should have realized this would happen,
Dad murmurs, his voice as shaky as I feel.
Those idiots building the pylons there and no markers.
He pulls me further towards him, so close that I think for a second I hear his heart. I concentrate everything I have on listening for it, anything to drown out the sound of the birds all around. Thud, thud. Dad's own wing beat. A gust of wind whips across my ears and under my collar, pushing my hair across my face. Dad picks up my coat from the path, where I've flung it, and wraps it around my shoulders.
Put it on,
he says.
It's cold.
I look up and see that his eyes are wet. Has it finished? He nods. I pull back to look up. There are no birds there now. Only a few feathers clinging to the wires. Did they... How many got hit? Dad's holding out the coat, trying to get me to put my arms through it.
The birds at the back had enough time to fly over. It's not so bad.
I turn to look behind me. Are they on the main lake? Dad shakes his head, glances at the sky.
Still up there. Doubt they'll winter here now.
I shield my eyes. Far above, the black specks of swans are flying fast towards the city, following the river. Dad's watching a single swan flying much closer to us, circling slowly around the reserve. It's a youngster, greyish and small, maybe a female. She's all by herself, left behind. I can tell by the way she keeps coming closer to the ground and then circling up again that she's confused, unsure if she should land. For one crazy minute, I wish that I could be up there with her, helping her fly, showing her where to go. Does she even realize that her flock is getting further away with each circle she makes? Again, there's that ache behind my ribs. I don't want to stop looking at her. It feels like if I do, she'll fall. Dad starts walking towards the small lake in front of us. He's heading for the reeds below the wires, the place where the swans fell. I run forwards to grab his arm.
We have to see, Isla,
he says firmly.
We might be able to save them.
I keep hold of him, even though he tries to shake me off to get to them. My eyes shift to the flattened reeds where the birds lie. I don't want to see the swans like this, broken and deformed. I want to remember them before they hit the wires, flying straight and perfectly, with the light glinting off their feathers. But I also know Dad's right. We have to save what we can. As Dad drags me closer, I see that there are three of them.
Only three, I say quietly. It could have been worse.
Their white, limp bodies are floating, caught in the reeds between the path and deep water, their feathers becoming waterlogged. Dad takes off his binoculars and gives them to me. He wades in.
But it's freezing,
I start to say, before Dad's sharp glance stops my words. He breathes in quickly as the water reaches his knees. There are patches of ice floating on the surface. I hear the squelch of his boots in the mud. He reaches the first one, drags it towards him and turns it over.
Dead,
he says. I watch his jaw clench. Dad hates dead things. He likes things that jump with life and energy, things like him. He wades further into the next bird, and I move towards the bank. Let me help.
No, it's really cold.
The first one Dad touched drifts towards me. I bend down, reach out and grab its wing. I tow it to me. There is a deep red gash running across the bottom of the bird's neck, wire-sized. The feathers are singed black around it and smell strangely like burnt plastic. I touch my fingers to the bird's chest. It's still warm, but there's no heartbeat. I turn away from the bird's still, glazed eyes. Dad is feeling the next one.
Dead,
he mutters again. He watches my face, checking to see if I'm upset, before moving on to the last bird. This one's smaller than the rest, and its feathers are greyish-brown. A young one, on its first migration, probably. Perhaps it's the brother of the other one we saw flying around the reserve. It's not fair that it's travelled so far, only to crash like this at the end. Dad has to wade in almost to his hips to reach it. The wind gets stronger then, making the reeds hiss and the breath catch in my throat. Come out of there, Dad, I say, pulling my hair back from where it's whipping over my eyes. It's freezing, you'll die of something. But already, he's moving back towards me, dragging the swan through the water.
Here, help me,
he says. He sticks his arms under the water's surface and lifts the bird. He steps towards the bank and I reach out. Limp, wet wings brush against me. A small hiss comes from the bird's throat. I try not to look at the burnt gash on this bird's shoulder as I shift my hands to get a better grip.
It's alive, Isla,
Dad whispers.
This one's alive.
Chapter 3 Dad carries the swan back through the reserve. I have to run to keep up. One of the swan's wings drapes over Dad's arm. It's crooked, probably broken.
It'll die if we leave it here,
he says. The swan opens its beak as if it's going to peck Dad's arm, but it's too weak even for that. It's as though it's given up already. Where are you taking it? I ask.
A vet somewhere. What's open on a Sunday?
We should take it to Grandad's, I say. Dad stops to look at me.
I don't think that's such a good idea.
Why not? He's on this side of town, and his vet stuff's still in the cottage. Dad's cheeks are flushed now from carrying the bird. He shifts it slightly in his arms as he thinks.
He won't treat a swan.
He fixed up his neighbour's dog last year when it got run over. He can still fix things.
He won't want to fix this.
We reach the car. I stick my arms under the swan and help carry it so Dad can get the keys from his pocket. I can feel the dampness of the feathers even through my clothes. It's hard to hold the bird still, but it's more awkward than heavy. My face is so close. I see its eyes try to focus first on me, then on Dad. Its beak is open with its pinky black tongue lolling to the side. I want to drip water into its mouth. It's not going to last, Dad, I say again. Grandad's is the closest place. Dad nods reluctantly as he opens the boot.
Grandad won't like it.
He goes silent like he always does when someone wants to talk about Grandad. He puts the seats down in the back so the bird will fit. Then he takes the swan from me, and together we lay it in the boot. Sweat beads form on Dad's forehead, which is odd because the bird isn't that heavy. And Dad's strong, maybe the strongest person I know. You okay? I ask. Dad doesn't answer, just shifts the bird's weight in my direction as we both lower it gently. I try to stretch the broken wing out. I feel all those tiny bones, barely beneath the surface. There's one sticking up where it shouldn't, almost breaking through the skin. I touch it, feel its jaggedness beneath my fingers like tiny teeth. The swan bites me on the hand, hard. It even draws blood. It hisses until I stop touching. I'm sorry, I murmur, sucking at the blood. I turn back to Dad. He looks worse now. His hand is pressing against the side of the car and his head is bowed. He's breathing heavily. Dad? He waves me away.
I'm fine.
I get to his side, wait until he looks at me. I forget about the swan for a moment. Dad's face is so red and sweaty. You were cold a moment ago, I say. You were shivering from the water. Now you're hot.
I'm fine, he says again.
Shall I call Mum?
No.
He straightens up to show me he's okay, but I can see the effort of moving makes him wince.
That chap was heavy, that's all.
He smiles a little, tries to make a joke of it, but his eyes won't hold my gaze, and I don't believe him. He steps towards the driver's door. I stop him from getting in. I'm calling Mum, I say, fumbling for the phone in my pocket. Or Grandad, he's closer. Maybe you shouldn't drive.
I'm okay,
Dad says firmly.
I can drive to Grandad's, drive home even. Stop worrying.
I keep my hand on his arm. It's the only thing I can do to stop him from getting in. Mum said you were sick, I say quietly. She said you were sent home from work.
Did she?
He wipes his hand across his forehead, his eyes flicking away angrily. Then he sighs, leans back against the car to look at me.
I'm cold and wet, and that thing was heavy, that's all. The quicker we get to Grandad's, the better, yes? That swan's going to die otherwise.
I nod, reluctantly, as he turns to open the door. I glance around the car park. There's still no one else here. Suddenly, I just want to get out of there. Take Dad somewhere it's not only me around. I'm calling Mum if you're not better soon, I say.
Fine.
He brushes my words off with a flick of his hand. I watch every single move he makes as he gets into the car. He's frowning a little, and his skin looks tight. If he's worried, he's trying to cover it up in front of me. But this isn't the first time this has happened. Mum said that when Dad was chopping branches in the city park, he had chest pains then, too. That's why he was sent home early. I get into the car, still watching him. I look over at the swan in the back. It's not moving, though it's still making a low, hissing noise. I touch its wing and hope we all make it safely to Grandad's. Dad tries to smile at me as we pull out of the car park.
He'll be okay,
he says, nodding at the swan. But I don't know whether it's the swan or him I'm more worried about. I hold my breath all the way down the lane until we're back on the ring road. There are other cars around now, more people than just me and Dad. And it's not far to Grandad's house. Chapter 4. I can't remember the last time I went to Grandad's. It must have been months ago, back in the summer. Dad tries to avoid Grandad in the winter, says he's too grumpy and takes longer to warm up. The turnoff is only a few miles down the ring road, but I watch Dad carefully all the way. He drives slowly but confidently, his skin gradually turning back to its normal colour. It feels strange pulling into Grandad's lane. The hedgerows seem so much smaller and deader. But then it is winter. I glance at the new dairy farm that's been built right next door, the one Grandad hates so much. A cow lifts her head and watches us as we pass. The engine strains as the tyres churn through the puddles of Grandad's drive. The house is how I remember it, maybe just a little more run down. The big tree out front is fragile-looking without its leaves, and the front gate is off its hinges. No dogs come running to greet us as they would have once. It's quiet and cold when Dad turns off the engine. Dad gets out quickly and goes around to the boot. I'll take it, I say, reaching for the swan.
I'm fine, I told you,
he growls, a little angry with me now. He places his hands under the bird and lifts it up. I run ahead to get the door.
There's no answer at the front, so I run around to the back. Dad follows slowly behind. I watch him as carefully as I can, checking to see if he looks as weak as he did at the reserve. But he's better now, strong like he normally is. Grandad is in his conservatory, sitting in the cane chair that looks out over the fields behind his house. I turn and try and see what he's looking at. Cows, fields. I can't see his lake from here. I stand on my tiptoes and listen for the sound of swans. Maybe the flock has gone there. But Dad's caught up with me now and has seen where I'm trying to look.
Not a chance, he says. It's too built up now for swans. They won't like the dairy farm.
I keep standing on my tiptoes, hoping to capture a glimpse of the water. But there's too much field and too many cows in between. The flock has to go somewhere. Dad shakes his head.
That lake's ruined from the cows.
He looks back at Grandad in the conservatory.
Get the door.
Dad's cheeks are going red again, and I see the strain in his face. Grandad still hasn't noticed us, so I have to rap on the window to get his attention. His eyes open wide as he sees me, as if he's trying to work out who I am. I hear his old dog, Dig, start to growl. Grandad looks behind me, his lips pressing together as he spots Dad struggling with the swan. He takes a key from under an empty plant pot and opens the door.
Why have you brought me this?
He says immediately.
No hellos, then,
Dad mutters. I step forward to explain. It flew into a power line above the wetlands reserve. We thought you could fix it. Dad nods at that. Grandad flicks his eyes skyward.
This thing's alive? It is at the moment,
Dad says. Grandad turns away.
You know I don't fix swans.
I reach out and grab his arm. Please, I say. My eyes dart to Dad's face. Just help us carry it to your surgery. Grandad follows my glance and looks more carefully at Dad. Perhaps he also sees that Dad doesn't look well, because all of a sudden he sighs and reaches for the swan's shoulder. The surprise registers in Dad's eyes as Grandad takes the weight of the bird and lifts it right out of Dad's arms. Grandad doesn't look down at the swan, though. He keeps glaring at Dad.
Not worried about my shaky hands now, then, he murmurs.
I brace myself, wait for them to start arguing. They usually do at some point. But Grandad sighs slowly.
You've got a nerve bringing this,
he says.
It was her idea,
Dad says, nodding at me.
I was going to take it to a proper vet.
I grab Grandad's arm and lead him towards the cottage before he can say anything else to Dad. You okay with that? I ask. But Grandad's not struggling with the weight of the bird at all. As we walk the 20 meters or so to the cottage, I glance across the fields again. There are no birds in the air. No birds anywhere. No sound of swans. I switch on the lights in the old cottage surgery. It all looks the way I remember it, just smells different. The medical posters on the walls are turning yellow at the edges, curling up over the blue tack. Grandad carries the bird through the reception area and into the operating room, lays it on the steel table. Dad follows after us a moment later, shutting Dig outside. The smell is stronger in the operating room. It's clean-smelling and dead-smelling at the same time, as if Grandad has wiped down all the benches with a skeleton. I remember the last time we were all here like this. It was a couple of years ago, and Grandad's other dog, Rocky, lay between us, fur blooded from the truck that slammed into him. His head had lolled to the side when Grandad injected the anaesthetic. He'd never woken up. Dad creaks open a window and stands near it, breathing deeply. Then he sees me watching and jerks his head towards the swan. So I go back to Grandad. He's running his hands over the bird's body. He shakes his head as he touches the wings. I reach out and stroke its neck, touch the wet, cold feathers. Can you fix him? I ask. Grandad doesn't answer, just keeps pressing his fingers to the swan.
He stares up at Dad.
We couldn't leave him,
Dad says quietly.
He would have died there. He'll die anyway,
Grandad says.
He's in a right mess.
I step away from the table. I don't want to believe him, but the swan's eyes are starting to close and there's a horrible gurgling noise in its throat. You can't do anything. Grandad stops staring at Dad and looks at me instead. His face changes as he watches me, becomes kinder somehow.
This bird has broken its wing quite seriously,
he says.
I could try and pin it, but I suspect that his liver also burst from impact with the water. That's why he's making that sound.
Dad turns away from the window, steps towards Grandad.
You must be able to do something,
he says, staring him full in the face with his cheeks reddening. I remember how flushed and sick he looked as he leant against the car in the reserve. I don't want it to happen again here.
Try something,
Dad whispers.
A bullet?
They stare each other out. The swan's leg moves a little and I glance back to it, wondering how much pain the bird is really in. He's brave about it, that's for sure. When I look back at Dad, he's watching me, wanting to know if I'm about to cry, probably. But like the swan, I'm good at holding stuff in. If the bird's in pain, I say, maybe Grandad's right. Grandad turns away and loads up a syringe, drawing up some sort of liquid from a glass vial, then flicks the top of it. Grandad catches Dad's stare and frowns. His hands shake as he moves the needle towards the swan's neck. I expect Dad to say something, but he doesn't. I know he's thinking it, though. Grandad's hands were shaking like this when he put the anesthetic into Rocky's body, too. That won't kill him with it, I ask. Grandad pricks the swan's skin.
No, just makes things easier. It won't be long, though, until he...
I think he wants to say more, but he's not sure how. Instead, he presses down on the syringe and the liquid glides into the bird. I watch the swan's eyes shut. The skin on its eyelids is wrinkled and slack, like the skin on the back of Grandad's hand. But the bird's still breathing, just. Grandad slides the needle out from the bird's neck.
I'll make him a bed out there.
He nods towards the room at the back of the cottage, where small animals were sometimes kept overnight. I run my hand down the broken wing. The swan doesn't flinch now, too deep in sleep. I let Grandad turn me away from the swan and push me from the room. Dad shuts the window with a thud.
Come on, Isla, we're going,
he murmurs, grabbing me by the back of my coat. I look around to see Grandad's face cloud over. He shakes his head, then turns abruptly away. He marches back to the house and slams the conservatory door. Dad shrugs.
He's just a grumpy old coot, always has been.
He walks quickly to the car. I hold back a little, wait for Grandad to sit in his cane chair by the window again. But Dad starts the car, and I run to get in it. Chapter 5 Mum's waiting at the door when we get home, looking from Dad's face to me and back
again. You had the pains again, didn't you?
She grabs Dad's shoulders and stops him from going in the house until he looks at her.
Something like that,
Dad murmurs.
But it's the swans you should worry about. Flew into the wires at the reserve.
She leads him into the kitchen, ignoring his explanation of what we did today.
That's the second time this has happened now, isn't it?
She glances over at me before lowering her voice.
You're going to the doctor first thing. Sure, sure.
Dad brushes away her concern, catches sight of Jack in front of the telly. Jack shuffles over on the couch, making way for him, and Dad's already talking about the swans.
The power lines, right?
Jack asks.
No markers.
Dad shakes his head.
Swans didn't have a chance.
He flops down next to Jack, and the energy seems to drain out of him immediately. He's suddenly as saggy as the couch. Mum comes over to where I'm still standing by the door, takes my head between her cool fingers. "You all right, babe?" she asks. She's looking at me carefully. I try to force my features into a grin and reassure her. It's not me I want her to be worried about. "I'm fine," I say. I want to tell her that Dad's not, though. I want to tell her how sick he looked at the reserve, but already she's hugging me against her fleecy jumper and brushing her fingers through my hair.
"Pizza for lunch?"
I wince as her fingers get caught in a knot. She takes a comb from her bag and tries to brush through it. I pull away from her strokes, go upstairs and change out of my muddy trousers. When I come back down, Dad has changed too. He's sitting back on the couch in his pyjama bottoms. I sit on the floor, lean up against his leg. Dad's still talking about the swans, trying to work out where the rest of the flock has moved on to.
"Maybe they've gone back up north," Jack suggests.
Dad's not convinced.
"There are other lakes around that part of town," he says. "Behind the factories, the hospital. The swans are still nearby." "You can feel it, can you?"
Jack smirks at Dad. He always makes fun of the way Dad thinks he has some sort of psychic connection with swans.
"Yeah."
Dad smiles crookedly.
"I'd feel it if they went somewhere else, sure."
Jack squawks with laughter, and Dad joins in a little.
"What?"
Dad protests, still smiling.
"I would."
I think about that young grey swan circling round the wetlands on her own. Would Dad also feel it if she went? Would anyone? I turn around to face Dad. "Can we keep looking for the swans tomorrow after school?" I ask. "Maybe go back to the reserve?" Dad starts to nod, but Mum's in the doorway straight away.
"Doctor first," she growls.
Dad holds his hands up in surrender. He winks at me.
"Sorry, bird,"
he says.
"Soon."
I turn back to the telly, rest my head against Dad's knee. It's kind of nice to hear him call me by my kiddie name again. He hasn't done it for ages. It's what he started calling me when I was a baby, before I had a name. He said I looked like a tiny bird, something fallen from a high place. It makes me feel small and young to hear it again. Jack turns the telly volume down on the hospital drama he's been watching to talk to Dad. I can smell the mud on the bottom of his trousers and guess he's been playing football this morning. I think about last weekend when he let me and Saskia come with him. He didn't seem to mind too much, even though his mates were all there. Sometimes he's good like that. Or maybe he just felt sorry for me because he knew Saskia was leaving. Maybe Mum told him to do it. The hospital show switches to an operation scene, and I turn away from it. Instead, I remember playing in Jack's football game, how Crowy, Jack's friend, passed the ball across to me. It felt like I could run with it forever, all the way down the pitch with Saskia cheering on the side. All the way to the moon. That's what I feel like doing now, running. My mind is full of images of the dead swans. Running helps with getting rid of images somehow. The faster you run, the harder it is for thoughts to stay in your head. Dad starts telling Jack about how the swans hit the wires. Jack wants to know every detail. The smell, what bones were broken, how cold the water was. It makes me feel sick hearing them talk about it. I try not to hear what Dad's saying by pressing my ear more firmly against the material of his pyjamas. Then the phone rings. I feel Dad's leg tense when Mum answers.
"I'm sorry to hear that, Martin,"
I hear Mum say.
"I'll let them know now."
She waits a second or two before she comes into the living room. I know already what she's going to say. I see the frown on Mum's face as she tries to work out how to tell us. "It's the swan, isn't it?" I ask. She just nods. I hear Dad sighing behind me, thumping his head back onto the couch.
"Should have taken it to a proper vet,"
he murmurs. Chapter 6. The rain lashes against the car as Mum drives Jack and me to school. Mum's talking quietly about Dad, telling us he needs to get tests done this week.
They think it might be his heart,
Mum murmurs. I can't hear the rest of what she says above the sound of the rain. I look down Saskia's road as we pass it, or the road that used to be her road. The for sale sign is still in front of her house. I hated helping her pack up her room last week, taking down all the silly photos of us she'd stuck to the wall. Hated watching her family drive away. I press my forehead to the cold window glass, wonder what school will be like without Saskia. She'll be up in Glasgow by now, already starting at a new school, making new friends, fitting in, forgetting me. I don't want to think about it. Instead, I scan the sky. I'm looking for the swan flock, though I know they won't be flying so close to the city. We drive past the corner shop where Saskia and I buy gummy bears. I glance back to the sky. Saskia's migrating too, sort of, though I don't know when she'll be coming back. Mum stops near the bus stop and jacks out of the car really quickly. He runs to catch up with Crowy and Rav, who are already at the school gates. I crane my neck to catch a glimpse of Crowy, but he's got his back to me, and I can only see his school jumper and longish hair. Mum turns around in her seat, waits for my kiss on her cheek.
You'll be all right without Sass, she says. You'll make new friends, you'll see.
But I'm not so sure. Art is first, and there's an empty seat next to me where Saskia would have sat. Usually I love art, because it's the only lesson I'm actually pretty good at. But without Saskia here, it's different somehow. The boys at the back stare at me when I come in, and Mrs. Diver gives me a small, sympathetic smile. I stretch out my stuff and sketch pad over the table, so no one else will sit next to me. We're going to keep focusing on our all-important observation skills, Mrs. Diver says. She places bits of fruit on everyone's desk, and we all groan. We already did still life last year. These skills will help us when it comes to your major projects for the term, she continues, which will be to do with movement and flying. I glance up at her then, and she places a wrinkly-looking apple on my desk. What's an apple got to do with flying? I murmur. Remember, a solid base in observation always helps you in design. She winks at me, then goes back to the pencil-sketched picture of Leonardo da Vinci that's always hanging up behind her desk. Remember Leo? She says. The greatest artist that ever lived. He did thousands of 2D designs before he ever attempted to make models. We'll find out about some of these sketches in our next lesson. She looks fondly at his old, wrinkly face, as if she were looking at a poster of her dad, rather than someone she'd never met. I go back to my apple. It has a soft brown bruise and a hole where a worm's eaten into it. It smells sweet and rotten, and it's the last thing I want to look at for the rest of the lesson. I sketch it out really quickly. Try and make your picture come alive, as 3D as you can. Mrs. Diver is waffling on and on, waving her hands about like she does when she gets excited. I turn towards the window. The rain is still so heavy, and the sky is grey as concrete. I wonder where the swans go in weather like this. I think of them huddling together, heads tucked back into their feathers. I wonder if the rain's been too heavy for Dad to drive to the surgery. I hear the boys at the back laughing as they talk to the new girl, Sophie. I think they're teasing her about her accent, saying something about didgeridoos and neighbours. I suppose I should invite her to sit next to me and give her a break from them. But I don't. I don't want anyone to sit there, not yet. No one apart from Saskia. It seems wrong to have a new girl in our class already, someone to replace her. I fold my arms on the table and rest my head down onto them and listen to the pattering of the rain against the windows. It sounds a bit like swans taking off from a lake, their webbed feet smacking against the water. Chapter 7 Dad's in and out of the doctor's surgery for most of the week, getting tests done and finding out what's wrong. He pulls me aside on Saturday morning, right after I've stuck bread in the toaster. But instead of telling me if he's sick, he says,
"Let's go to the reserve today. Find the swans and take some photographs."
"Why photographs?" He flashes a piece of paper at me, which I have to grab from him to read. It's some official-looking letter he's typed out.
"I've written to the council,"
he explains.
"Told them what happened with the swans and the power lines. Now we just need photos. Evidence."
He's grinning excitedly. "But are you okay now?" I ask. "With the tests and everything?" Dad rolls his eyes.
"I don't look sick, do I?"
I shake my head slowly. Because he doesn't. Not right now when he's jumping around the kitchen, thinking up plans. "But Mum said..." Dad shrugs.
"Until the doctors know what's wrong, I'm not getting worried about anything. It's probably all just a false alarm anyway."
He can see I'm still reluctant. He sighs as he leans back against the counter.
"What about if I take you to get your hair cut after the reserve?"
Dad crosses his arms and waits for my answer. He has been listening then. All those times when I've pleaded with Mum to take me to the hairdresser. "Mum would kill you," I say, starting to laugh at him. Dad frowns as he thinks about it.
"I'll say you wanted me to take you before I go into hospital."
"Hospital?" There's a soft clunk from the toaster, but I ignore the toast and keep looking at Dad. "What do you mean, hospital?" Dad reaches across to pick the toast out. He flings it quickly onto the bench as it burns his hands.
"It's nothing serious," he says quickly. "They just want to stick a tube thing into my heart, see what's going on in there."
"That sounds serious."
"I'm only in for a day, a couple of hours, really."
He smiles at me, then leans forward to touch my hair.
"So, reserve first, then haircut?"
He curls a strand of hair around his finger, and then lets it bounce back into place. I study his face. "What if something happens at the reserve?" "Like last time," I want to add.
"What can happen?"
he says.
"Anyway, don't you want to find the swans?"
I nod. "Course, but..."
"Settled then."
He picks the toast up from the bench and flings it at me. I catch the two pieces, just. I dig in the fridge for the butter. I use Jack's dirty plate, avoiding the Marmite stains as I cut the toast into four. Dad reaches over my shoulder and grabs a quarter.
"Hey!"
I slap his hand, but he moves away before I can grab the toast back. He grins, only a little apologetic.
"We're going to find that flock today," he says. "I can just feel it. We'll look at the reserve, but there are other lakes around we can try. I'm pretty sure there's one by the hospital for a start."
He crunches down loudly on the toast, and I move the plate before he can get another piece. Dad does seem better today, back to his usual self. Maybe he is right when he says it's all just a false alarm. Chapter 8. A few hours later, I lean back against the seat and watch the streets blur past. The Saturday shoppers trudge around in thick coats. I lean over and turn the car's heating up a notch. I can hear Dad's stomach rumbling, so I dig into my pocket and find an old barley sugar left over from a previous trip and hand it to him.
"How do you want your hair?"
Dad asks, rolling the sweet around in his mouth and clinking it against his teeth.
"You should get it all short and spiky. You'll be like a proper bird then, bird."
That's exactly how I want it. Spiky, like a cartoon character. Something different.
"I'll call you Tufted Duck,"
Dad laughs.
"Only you won't dye it white in the middle, will you?"
I take my mobile from my pocket and text Saskia to ask what she thinks. Dad turns into the car park and switches the engine off. He reaches around to grab the camera from the back seat.
"Ready?"
"If you are." There are five other cars here. There'll be people around if Dad looks sick again. We keep silent as we go up the lane, both listening for the swans. Dad watches the sky, one hand already on his binoculars. I look up too, watching for that grey youngster we saw last time. I'm watching Dad also. But if he feels sick, he doesn't show it. I shut my eyes for the last few seconds before we turn the corner and see the water. The swans aren't there. The lake is empty, apart from a couple of coots dipping in and out. Dad sighs.